Despair and illusion border our lives. Behind us is the pressure of evolution. Ahead is life. No matter what confronts us, we must always move in a forward direction. We have to progress, and we hope to reach the point where despair and illusion are overcome. When we discover that even a further location, that of faith and knowledge, is not enough to satisfy our lives, we must turn to the task of seeking righteousness. If I were offered the opportunity to add additional law to our 10, mine would read, "Righteousness, righteousness, shalt thou pursue." Many men have searched for a meaningful philosophy, but they have deduced that each individual forms his own ideals and beliefs. All these beliefs are similar in one respect. They deal with a problem of meeting life. Inherent in this confrontation with life is man's long heritage of war and the intervals of peace. With war comes despair, frustration, and destruction. With the advent of peace comes the possibility of progress towards righteousness. Whether people believe a war is justifiable or not, everyone wants it to end. The search for peace, as the search for all aged humanity, from medicine to literature, is required by the basic philosophy of mankind. All men have hopes which are mental images of what they wish their lives to be. Each man hopes to use his ideas in his approach to life. I am sure there are as many ways of meaning life as there are men, but all men agree on life's basic meanings. Life can be divided into five different parts: religion, philosophy, science, aesthetics, and society. Religion is the most constant and common of these attitudes. Religion can offer us a meaningful way of life. Religion is primarily concerned with the preparation of man for the messianic age. Religion, with its doctrines and precepts, offers man the chance to attempt to seek an age for himself when world harmony will reign. By doing this, man's dream of eternal peace will be fulfilled, and religion's emphasis on the sacredness of human life will be rewarded. In modern religion, symbolic acts are accessible to gain divine intervention. Each person adjusts religion to suit his own needs and character. We must rationalize our present dissatisfaction by hopes of eventual success. Because views and objections can be made on the war in Vietnam on moral, political, and social grounds, the religious viewpoint is often neglected. The sacredness of human life and what it can accomplish is cherished by religion above all things. Even a necessary war violates the spirit, and it is religious duty to attempt to halt all killing at all time. For without the backbone of belief and faith in life, religion loses all meaning and relevance. It is easy to laud Israel's desperate victory over the Arab nations, but it must not be forgotten that many lives were forfeited in this unnecessary struggle, and many more are in danger of losing their lives unless the world takes strong steps to control those who hate. It is religion's duty to initiate this concern throughout the individual and to restore in him faith in humanity. To me, religion is faith, a dependence on a positive way to reach my goals, a task that sometimes seems hopeless. When there were no telephones and few doctors, men depended upon prayer to heal the sick. That was their religion, man's use of a spiritual middleman to achieve his goals. To believe that there is a way to adjust to the hardest difficulties of life is to be religious. Since no one becomes an adolescent without having adjusted to childhood, or an adult without having adjusted to adolescence, religion seems similarly stable. Philosophy teaches us to search for meaningful ideas and an awareness of the needs they fill. A philosopher who regards life as a man is more useful than an academic literary philosopher. The truly human philosopher will have his likes and dislikes without being tied to a narrow set of philosophical rules. Each man's beliefs will formulate his ideals in life. Philosophical tracts have been published for centuries on the pros and cons of war. There are few philosophers, however, who have dealt totally with the aspects of peace. Sir Thomas More attempted this in his study of the perfect society. He ended up, however, calling it utopia, which means nowhere. It does not seem necessary for philosophy to revert to the cynicism of More's title. The individual, whether or not he believes in the possibility of a lasting and worldwide peace, must still formulate his beliefs along the guidelines that peace can be a reality and not a wishful dream. To be all you can and to live as much as you can is to exemplify in fine fashion the true philosophic way of life. To adjust to the scientific way of life is to become obsessed with understanding and controlling the course of nature. The scientific way of life differs from philosophy in confining itself solely to the realm of nature. It does not seek to change things through the disciplines of religion, but to change things directly. Cancer is slowly destroying human life, and relief is sought. The only realistic way of solving the problem is to discover the cause, isolate it, learn its structure and antidotes, and then immunize other human beings to it by means of knowledge gained by laborious research. Prayer will not prevail in the realm of science. The scientific method differs from the aesthetic method by its emphasis upon interrelationship of facts and ideas. The aesthete can regard each experience as singular and unique. It is as it appears by itself. The scientist knows that nothing exists without a cause, not even the cause itself. To the scientist, ideas are the effects of occurrences. In the realm of cause and effect, science finds itself in a sometimes contradictory position. While devising benefits that facilitate the growth of mankind in countless ways, science has also developed deadly machines that retard and destroy life. Although original atomic research was not weapon-oriented, the hydrogen bomb leveled a Japanese city that modern technological knowledge had erected. From Hiroshima to the testing grounds of New Mexico, science finds itself playing the game of trying to keep humanity alive by building weapons of death. Eventually, science may outwit itself and destroy itself, but using the fantastic progress made in the last decade as evidence, it can be hoped that science can effectively control itself and bring a peace that will be worthwhile to keep. To live life aesthetically is to take ideas as they are. Something always precedes ideas and usually follows them. If I concentrate on the present without relating my past experiences to my present dilemmas, or without evaluating these problems in relationship to the future, I will be living an aesthetic life. The aesthete is concerned with the present to such a great extent that he becomes immune to the lessons of experience and disavows responsibility for any future consequences of present actions. In this manner, the aesthetic ignores the dangers of modern society and lives solely for its benefits. Like the scientist, the artist must come to the realization that what he does today will affect tomorrow, and what happened yesterday has affected today. The dropping of the atom bomb solved the crisis of the present, but it caused a spiraling arms race in the future. Again, this notion of cause and effect must be heeded, or aesthetics will no longer have a present to cherish. There is one other speculative way of regarding life. This is the emphasis on the moral, on the social element, the society around us. To live a complete life in all respects, one must involve himself in the surrounding civilization. Religion, philosophy, science, and aesthetics are all meaningless out of the context of society. Man is a social animal. He has the inherent sense of reason, but society develops and sharpens that sense. To be righteous, a man must be familiar with religion, philosophy, science, and aesthetics. But most of all, you must use the knowledge gained in these activities to better society in any way possible. This is the true meaning of righteousness. It transcends all the aforementioned classifications. It incorporates them all. If true righteousness is employed in all fields, the result will be the realization of the messianic doctrine and the fulfillment of world harmony and peace. With this goal in mind, righteousness, righteousness, shalt thou pursue.
Man has always sought to educate himself. Indeed, the one characteristic that God has given man in order to differentiate him from the other creatures of the animal kingdom is the ability to think, to comprehend, and to understand. Thus, man's desire to educate himself stems from his inherent capacity for learning and his insatiable thirst for knowledge. And it is this capacity and this thirst of man's that have played such important parts throughout history in the development of man's abilities. His abilities as an artist, as a thinker, as a scientific innovator, and his abilities as a religious scholar. Education has become increasingly important, so important that in 20th century America, it is a necessity to have an education. And accordingly, the growth of institutions of learning in America, most noticeably that of colleges and universities, has become unprecedented in world history. But to what end do we as modern Americans seek our degrees, our educational certificates of acquired knowledge? For is not the most learned man who cannot communicate, relate, and share his knowledge with others merely a useless storehouse of dates, theories, facts, and figures? Education is vital and necessary. But if we are to live in a world of peace with our neighbor, education must lead to an understanding between peoples, an understanding of similarities and of differences, an understanding of wants and of needs, and an understanding of the many practical commitments we all have and share towards each other. The need for understanding is great, and that is why I have chosen for my 11th commandment, seek to understand thy neighbor rather than to love him. The phrase, seek to understand thy neighbor, expresses the importance of education in our modern world. Yet, our education must lead to an understanding, which must invariably become first a self-awareness, and then a sensitivity to others. We must understand our neighbor so that we might listen to him, and exchange our ideas with him. We must lose our arrogance and our haughtiness in order to work better with our neighbor. As the book of Proverbs has told us when dealing with this question of to what end or purpose do we seek our knowledge, as tovin sedek umishpat umesharim kal magal tov ki tavo hachma v'libecha v'da'at v'nafshecha yin'am metzima tishmor alecha tivona tinsreka. Then you will understand righteousness and justice and equity, every good path, for wisdom will come into your heart and knowledge will be pleasant to your soul. Discretion will watch over you, and understanding will guard you. Thus, we must seek this desired dimension of education where we understand our neighbor as a result and live righteously. But although an understanding of our neighbor is desirable, love alone or in place of understanding is not. For love can be an uncontrollable force in our world. It is the aspect of the individual which knows no limitations. And by its very nature as this humanistic force, it is emotional rather than rational, and blind rather than lucid. The axiom, love is blind, applies aptly, for it is the same blind force of love in the world that also produces and breeds the equally powerful forces of hate, of prejudice, of anger, and of hostility. A world of carelessly blind love must and does contain within it the latent forces of hatred and prejudice, which do eventually manifest themselves and will continue to eventually manifest themselves in our so very human world. This is why we must understand our neighbor rather than love him. For it is only through a rational, educated understanding of other people will we ever be able to find true peace, indeed true happiness in our world. Amen.
Amen. Ten Commandments are something more than an arbitrary collection of moral precepts. They represent the quintessence of our doctrinal tradition, and they symbolize the entire range of Jewish discipline. Implicit in the Ten Commandments is the entire philosophic and religious structure of our faith. This becomes much clearer when we use to describe these Ten Commandments the Hebrew phrase, Aseret HaDibrot, the ten basic words, the ten foundation pillars. The Alexandrian Jewish philosopher of the first century, Philo, put it this way. Implicit in these ten words is the entire range of law. Any law which can claim justice, a concern for freedom, the individual and the society, is implicit within these ten short terms. Now, iconographically, symbolically, the Ten Commandments has, as you know, become a shorthand symbol for our tradition. The two tables of the law, rectangular, usually rounded at the top, incised with the Hebrew of the commandments, has become a familiar sign above our arks in our synagogues. A sign chosen by the armed forces when it wanted to designate quickly the mission of the rabbis who were serving in uniform as chaplains. We recognize this sign. We know that it signifies the tradition, its scope, its span. But interestingly, this symbol of the two tables of the law is not a very old one, at least not very old as Judaism numbers time. Probably goes back no more than 1,000 years. 1,000 years before that, and 1,000 years before that, the symbol of the Ten Commandments, which you'll find on some of the coins of the Hasmonean dynasty, in the mosaic floors of Hellenistic synagogues, on the sarcophagi of Roman Jews, it's a symbol of a shrine, two pillars fluted on the side, and the shrine is covered by a parochas, by a sacred canopy. This symbol suggests the commandments, but does not actually delineate them, force them before you. And the theory here, I believe, was that if we become too familiar with the commandments, if they seem too simple to us, they lose a good bit of their bite and of their impact. And interestingly, the same development can be traced in our liturgy. During the days of the Second Temple in the 3rd, 4th, 5th pre-Christian centuries, our fathers recited the Ten Commandments every morning at public worship, just before the recitation of the Shema. And then the sages declared that this custom was to be abandoned, because, they said, instead of suggesting the entire sweep of the Jewish discipline, many have come to feel that the Ten Commandments are in and of themselves the sum and substance of that discipline. And so, I would suggest to you as my 11th commandment, one which comes directly out of our experience with the first 10. And it's simply this. Don't take the Ten Commandments literally. Thou shalt not take thy faith simplistically. I read recently of a survey made of religious attitudes in which a carefully selected sample of people were asked whether they believed in the Ten Commandments and if they believed in them, whether they practiced them. Of the vast majority who believed in the Ten Commandments, 98% said that they practiced them, which can mean only one of two things. Either that 2% of the people in our world are responsible for all the mischief in our world, or else that most of us think of the Ten Commandments rather superficially. We look at them, we take their surface meaning, and we assume this to be all that Judaism's about. And so we read the Ten Commandments in this way. Thou shalt affiliate with a congregation and come occasionally to its worship. Thou shalt not be a pagan, but who today is an idolater? Thou shalt visit thy aging grandparents once or twice a month and write them a letter occasionally. Thou shalt light candles on Friday night. This is the Sabbath. Thou shalt not commit perjury. Thou shalt not commit murder. Thou shalt not commit larceny. Thou shalt not commit infidelity. But these are gross crimes, and after all, most of us are not tempted in these directions. And finally, thou shalt moderate thy acquisitive instinct somewhat, at least curb it within the terms of the family budget. Now, I would submit to you that this isn't what Judaism is all about, nor what the commandments are all about. Let's take one of them. Thou shalt not steal. What do we mean by theft? We mean larceny and burglary, of course. We also mean to short measure, false labeling, misrepresentation, the playing on another's confidence, taking advantage of another's anxiety or fear or ignorance or superstition. You can steal another's good name by gossip. You can steal a brother or sister's time with parents and grandparents by being greedy. You can steal a professional person's time by being silly and necessarily worried. You can steal from those whom you do not know by being passively a member of a society where injustice is the order of the day and where special groups receive special privilege. Thou shalt not steal is, in other words, not simply the easily understood law of respectability. Don't go out at night with a burglar's tools and break into some home. But it's a basic law which affects you and it affects me in every act and every judgment that we make. We should not steal another's thoughts, not give him credit. We should not steal another's hard work by peeking at his exam. We should not steal a march on another by taking advantage of opportunity which he does not have, of contacts which may not be his. But most of all, we must not be part of a world which denies to some group, which steals from some group, justice, freedom, and righteousness. Now, as you well know, the churches and synagogues in our day are very much concerned with being relevant. Why are they concerned? Because many of them, for long periods of time, have preached respectability, forgotten about righteousness. They've preached the expected, the simplistic virtues, courtesy and good manners, respect for parents, because after all, parents pay the dues of a congregation. The virtues of learning, the virtue of correctness and of rectitude. But when it came down to an analysis of the social order, when it came down to some sophisticated concern, the real bite, thrust, the basic discipline which requires that we respect and be concerned with others, we devote our lives to freedom and to justice, to goodness. When it came to these terms, often the synagogue and the church were unfortunately silent. And translate from the institution to the individual, from me to you. It is easy to live and to feel oneself responsible and respectable, and even to win the respect of some within the community by walking a rather narrow world road, concerned only with your achievements, with your talents, with your taxes, with your obligations within the family, within your business, within your profession. But if the Ten Commandments have any real meaning, if we take them not narrowly but broadly, as we must take them, sacredly, to represent all that Judaism is about, And we cannot look straight ahead, but we must look to all sides. We cannot look only to our family, but to the poor, to the outcast, to the underprivileged, to those we hardly know. We cannot be concerned only with achievement, but we must be concerned also with the quality of life in our community. We cannot be concerned only with our paycheck, but we must be concerned with principle and with righteousness. The miracles of the electronic age. Once upon a time, a rabbi would only be too concerned that his congregation would talk back to him. Now we're getting it from outside, too. Well, that is a good place to pause. Life has its moments of seriousness, happiness. This is a happy moment for all of us. I watched you from consecration through confirmation now to graduation. You've grown. You've matured. You're not yet fully mature, but then who is? A great future awaits you. I've been very pleased with the quality of the work that you've done for us these last few years. I wish you in your religious life a life of search, a life of deep meaning. For I hope that you have sensed the depths and the possibilities of Judaism. That Judaism is not a matter of labels or of superficial things, but like any honest religious tradition, it is an attempt to understand what is required of us and by whom. It is an attempt to suggest to you the inherited wisdom of the ages and the wide range of duty and obligation which rest upon us because of the historical tradition which is ours, because of the gift of life from a kind God, and most of all, because of the strength of your youth. Amen.